Welcome back to the Deep Dive, where we take your stack of source material, strip away all the noise, and just hand you the precise knowledge you need to be truly well-informed. Today, we are getting into the foundational pillars of U.S. business finance. We're talking about the financial DNA, you know, the core three, assets, liabilities, and equity.
Mm-hmm.
Our mission is to give you a kind of shortcut to real financial literacy. We're pulling out the most critical and honestly sometimes surprising insights from U.S. accounting rules. That's GAAP.
And the IRS tax regulations.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And by the end of this, you won't just know the definitions. You'll understand the complete financial story a company is telling.
And that story, it lives entirely on one document, the balance sheet. You should think of it as a snapshot of financial tension.
Okay, a snapshot. I like that.
It's a single moment in time where everything a business owns is perfectly balanced by everything it owes, plus what's left for the owner.
Assets equals liabilities plus equity.
That's the one. And this is not just theory. I mean, mastering this balance is absolutely vital for attracting investors, getting loans, and really achieving sustainable growth. Doesn't matter how big or small your business is.
All right, let's start with the engine then. Assets. Forget the formal jargon for just a second.
Right.
An asset is simply anything the company owns that, you know, puts money in your pocket or helps you create future value. It's the economic power base.
And to really gauge that power, the first thing we look at is liquidity. How fast can that asset turn into cold, hard cash? So we start with current assets.
Things that should convert within a year.
Exactly.
And we all know cash is king, but our sources really emphasized a key operational best practice for U.S. small businesses, which is maintaining a robust cash reserve.
Mm-hmm. A cushion.
A serious cushion. We're talking 3 to 6 months of operating expenses just sitting there. I mean, if the pandemic taught us anything, it's that liquidity is the difference between surviving a crisis and just closing up shop.
It's the ultimate shock absorber. And right behind cash, you have accounts receivable, AR.
The money your customers owe you.
Right. In the U.S., standard payment terms are usually net 30, maybe net 60. But here's a critical GAAP rule. You have to be conservative. You can't just report the total amount you're owed.
You have to assume some people won't pay.
Precisely. You have to set aside an allowance for doubtful accounts. This actually reduces the AR on your books to what you realistically expect to collect. It forces a dose of realism onto the balance sheet.
That's the GAAP conservatism principle again. Okay, but here's where the U.S. context gets, I think, really fascinating. Inventory.
Oh, yeah.
If you sell physical goods, inventory is a huge current asset, and the U.S. tax code gives companies choices on how to value it. FIFO, LIFO, weighted average.
And the key pivot point here is LIFO. Last in, first out.
Right.
It is, and this is important, uniquely American, and it creates a direct conflict with international standards.
Also.
Well, when prices are rising, inflation, for instance, LIFO assumes you sell your newest, most expensive inventory first. This raises your cost of goods sold, which lowers your reported profit. And, well,
it lowers your tax bill.
It lowers your taxable income, exactly.
Okay, wait. If LIFO saves a business tax money, why is it banned almost everywhere else under IFRS? I mean, does the U.S. rule really tell the true story of profitability?
It tells a different story. IFRS argues that FIFO first in, first out is a much better reflection of how goods actually flow and what true profitability is. So they just prohibit LIFO.
So the fact the IRS allows it gives U.S. companies a unique domestic advantage.
It does. But it also means a U.S. company using LIFO can look less profitable on paper than an identical international competitor using FIFO.
Wow. That is a massive detail. Oh. It totally changes how you interpret the numbers. Okay, so let's move on to the long-term muscle. Non-current assets.
These are the investments that deliver value over multiple years. We're talking about property, plant, and equipment, PP&E.
The big stuff. Buildings, machinery.
Right. And GAAP requires these to be recorded at historical cost, and then their value is slowly reduced through depreciation over their useful lives.
But that depreciation schedule isn't always slow and steady, right?
Yeah.
Especially for tax purposes. Our sources highlight some pretty aggressive U.S. tax incentives here.
Oh, definitely. You need to know two terms, Section 179 and MTRS.
Okay, break those down.
So think of Section 179 as a huge one-time discount sticker the IRS lets you put on new equipment. Instead of depreciating a machine over 10 years, U.S. law lets you deduct the full purchase price up to, over $1.2 million now in the year you start using it.
Whoa. So it massively accelerates the tax benefits.
Radically. It makes it so much more attractive to invest in new equipment right now.
That's a huge incentive for growth. Okay, moving past the physical stuff, we get to intangible assets, the knowledge economy.
Things like patents and trademarks. Patents give you 20 years of exclusivity. But an interesting gap rule is unless you bought the patent, the costs of developing it internally usually aren't capitalized as an asset.
But trademarks are different.
Very different. A trademark, like the branding for Coca-Cola or Apple, can last forever as long as it's being used. And then there's goodwill.
Ah, goodwill. This is the tricky one.
It's the hard-to-pin-down asset that only shows up after an acquisition. It's basically the premium you paid over the fair value of all the other assets you acquired.
And if you're analyzing a company, goodwill is important because U.S. GAAP requires it to be tested for impairment every single year.
Exactly. If that acquisition doesn't perform well, you could see a massive write-down of that goodwill, and that can crush a company's equity.
So we've covered the assets, the capacity of the business. But we can't look at that capacity without thinking about the cost of getting it.
Which brings us to the financial tension, the obligations, the liabilities.
Liabilities are basically financial obligations that require a future payment or service. They are what you owe.
And managing them is critical for stability and, you know, your creditworthiness. We split them just like assets. Current liabilities are due within a year.
And top of that list is accounts payable, or AP, what you owe your suppliers.
And smart management of AT is a huge cash flow booster.
Speaking of smart management, our sources brought up that classic strategic discount term, 210 net 30.
Right.
That means you get a 2% discount if you pay within 10 days. Otherwise, the full amount is due in 30. Yeah. That 2% doesn't sound like much.
But if you annualize it, it's a huge implied return on your cash. It's almost always worth taking that discount if you can.
Good point. Okay, what's next?
Then you have accrued expenses. These are obligations you've incurred but haven't been invoiced for yet. Think wages, vacation time, interest.
And for every U.S. business, this also includes taxes payable, especially those quarterly estimated taxes the IRS demands. Ignoring those is a recipe for disaster.
Cash crunch and penalties, for sure. And for short-term financing, we often see things like merchant cash advances, especially in retail or restaurants.
Right. Those are easy to get, but they can be a trap. The effective interest rate is notoriously high. It's kind of a red flag if a company relies on them too much.
It really is. And we have to talk about a liability that's just exploded in the digital world. Deferred revenue.
Unearned revenue. This is a big one for any subscription business.
Huge. It's money you've received up front, say, for a year-long software subscription for a service you haven't delivered yet. That cash is in your bank account, which is an asset.
But the obligation to provide the service for the next 12 months is a liability sitting right there on your balance sheet.
Exactly. Okay, so moving to the deeper obligations. Long-term liabilities due beyond 1 year. These are often for huge investments.
Like term loans. Mm-hmm. But the U.S. government is a big player here, right, with SBA loans?
A huge player. The SBA 7A program is so popular because it provides government-backed guarantees. This encourages banks to offer much longer repayment terms, sometimes up to 25 years for real estate. That's a total game changer for a small business trying to expand.
Now, for a major regulatory disruption, this one really changed the liability section for a lot of companies. Lease obligations.
Oh, this was a monumental shift. Historically, companies could hide major operating leases off the balance sheet.
Not anymore.
Not anymore. The 2019 implementation of ASC 842 basically forced businesses to recognize the value of almost all long-term leases as both an asset and a liability.
So it just appeared on the books overnight.
It added billions of dollars in debt to the balance sheets of asset-heavy firms like big retailers, and it instantly changed how leveraged they looked.
Wow. And finally, briefly, deferred tax liabilities.
This usually pops up because companies use one method for taxes and another for investors. They might use that accelerated depreciation, MACRS, to lower their current tax bill.
But use a slower, straight-line method for their financial reports to look more profitable.
Right. And that difference creates a timing issue. So you're basically admitting, hey, we'll owe more tax later. And that future obligation is the deferred tax liability.
Okay. So we've got the resources assets and the obligations liabilities. The final piece of the puzzle is equity, the owner's stake.
The residual claim. It's what's left over.
Equity is the cleanup crew. It's what's left for the owners if you sell all the assets and pay off all the debts. The difference between the two columns.
For corporations, this section really reveals investor commitment and the company's long-term success. It starts with common stock and additional paid-in capital, or APIC.
Right, and common stock is usually recorded at a tiny par value, like a penny a share.
Exactly. So the vast majority of cash investors actually pay goes into that APIC account. That's the real measure of how much capital was contributed initially.
Then you have retained earnings.
The cumulative total of all net income the company has ever earned minus any dividends it's paid out. And this number is heavily influenced by the C Corp tax structure here in the US.
The dreaded double taxation.
That's the one. The corporation pays tax on its profits, and then shareholders pay personal income tax on any dividends they get. Because of that, C Corp are often incentivized to just retain their earnings rather than distributing them.
Which is why you see some massive, highly profitable U.S. companies with these huge retained earnings balances on their books.
Correct. And finally, treasury stock. This is when a company buys back its own shares from the market.
A common practice for S&P 500 companies. It reduces the number of shares out there.
Which shrinks total equity, but it's done to return value to shareholders and boost earnings per share.
And just to cover our bases, for simpler structures like sole proprietorships, it's just owner's equity.
Yeah.
For LLCs, it's members' equity, which is part of their appeal, that flexibility.
Right.
So we've built the three components. Now, how do we use this? Let's look at the balance sheet as a whole and the ratios that give us that quick insight.
Okay, first, we have to reaffirm that fundamental equation. Assets, liabilities, plus equity.
The golden rule of accounting.
It is. Every single transaction a business makes has to keep that in perfect equilibrium. If you buy a machine, that's an asset going up.
So you either took out a loan, so a liability goes up, or you paid cash, so another asset went down. Mm-hmm. It has to balance.
It always balances. And when you look at a U.S. balance sheet, it almost always uses...
The report format.
The report format, a vertical list. Assets are at the top, ranked by liquidity cash first, then AR, then inventory. Liabilities follow, ranked by when they're due.
And that organization is what makes the ratios so powerful. Let's start with working capital.
Simple calculation. Current assets minus current liabilities. It tells you immediately if you have enough short-term resources to cover your short-term debts.
A bit more sophisticated is the current ratio. Current assets divided by current liabilities. This is the first number a lender looks at.
A ratio above 2.0 is generally considered pretty healthy. It means you have $2 of current assets for every $1 of current liabilities. Lenders usually look for something in the 1.5 to 3.0 range.
But the quick ratio, or the asset test, that's where you find the real story of safety, I think. It strips inventory out of current assets.
And why is that? Because inventory can become obsolete, or it might just take months to sell. It's not truly liquid.
Right. So if you take out inventory and that ratio is still above 1.0, it means the business can meet all its immediate obligations without having to sell a single piece of stock.
A much more conservative and often more telling measure. And finally, the big one for leverage, the debt-to-equity ratio.
Total liabilities divided by total equity, this is your risk meter.
It's exactly that. It measures how much the company relies on debt versus the owner's own investment. Lenders, for established businesses, they typically prefer a ratio below 2.0, much higher than that, and it starts signaling a lot of financial risk.
Which brings us to the practical application. Why we're learning this. This isn't just an accounting exercise.
Not at all.
That balance sheet supports every single strategic decision. A strong one low debt, high current ratio gets you better interest rates, better partners. It's your buffer against risk. We saw in 2020 that liquidity determined who survived.
And context is absolutely crucial. You have to benchmark against the industry. A manufacturing company will naturally have tons of PP&E and inventory.
Whereas a tech company might have huge cash reserves, a lot of intangible assets like patents, and those big deferred revenue liabilities from their subscription models.
And think about real estate. It runs on huge mortgage debt. High leverage is just standard practice. A debt-to-equity ratio that would be terrifying for a consulting firm is perfectly normal for a big manufacturer.
So how do you strengthen the picture? You have to actively manage these pieces.
You do. You improve your cash position by getting customers to pay faster. You strategically pay down that expensive debt first, like those merchant cash advances. You optimize inventory so it's not just sitting there.
And you have to remember that this entire picture is molded by the regulatory framework. GAAP principles like historical cost, and then IRS rules allowing for those aggressive tax plays like LIFO and Section 179.
And even if you run a private business, you are absolutely influenced by public company standards. Banks and investors expect strong internal controls, a practice heavily influenced by the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, even for non-public firms.
So we've drilled down into the core three, we've mapped them onto the balance sheet, and we've given you the tools, the ratios, the context to read a company's financial health like an expert.
At the end of the day, balance sheet health is an ongoing process. It's constant monitoring and strategic decision-making. These figures aren't just static numbers. They tell a powerful, continuous story of a company's resilience and its future potential.
That is the deep dive accomplished. And now, something for you to mull over as you go about your day.
Mm-hmm.
When you analyze a balance sheet, just remember that U.S. GAAP largely relies on the historical cost principle.
Right, what you originally paid for it.
Exactly. Yeah. So if the company you're examining was founded 50 years ago, how much do you think the actual market value of its property and its plant today might differ from the value you're seeing on its balance sheet?